Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we'll revisit the 1926 founding of Black History Month and the pivotal civil rights campaign in Birmingham. Then, our next guest suggests that the government may be overreacting and that the chance of being killed by an act of terrorism is far less than other dangers, such as gun violence. Finally, for President's Day, we'll take a peek inside the strange political marriage of Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon. Has Black History Month had its intended impact? V.P. Franklin is with us. He is a distinguished professor of history at University of California, Riverside. He's also the editor of the Journal of African American History, which was founded by Carter G. Woodson. And he's the author of several books, including The Education of Black Philadelphia, The Social and Educational History of a Minority Community, Black Self-Determination, A Cultural History of African American Resistance, and Living Our Stories, Telling Our Truths, Autobiography, and the Making of the African American Intellectual Tradition. Welcome, V.P. Franklin.
Good to be on here.
Great to have you here with us. I want to start with Black History Month and its importance in American history. Has Black History Month had its intended impact?
I think that considering where people began in terms of trying to remember African and African American past, when they started with Negro History Week back in 1926, I doubt that they would have thought that the entire nation would be celebrating a month that was devoted to African-American history. Carter G. Woodson and the founders of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History wanted to make the record clear and accurate and bring forth evidence to try to deal with the various negative portrayals of people of African descent that were abundant throughout U.S. society and popular culture. And they wanted to challenge those representations. And they put forward the Journal of Negro History and then Negro History Week and the Negro History Bulletin, which became the Black History Bulletin, to tell another story, to tell the African-American story, and to deal with distortions and other misrepresentations that were out there in the public.
Do we still have a long ways to go?
In terms of the people who originally started, I think that they will think that we have come quite far with the television shows and the documentaries and the proclamation. I think that they would think that we have come very far, but we have known more about the past, but we have not necessarily learned all the lessons that we need to learn from the past. And I think that the more time that we spend trying to investigate the past and see how it relates to the present, it may help us to decide on and how to figure out how to deal with the future.
Well, let's look at some of the past issues then. The Birmingham Civil Rights Movement, a movement credited by many to have really changed the course of not just U.S. history, but other histories of oppressed people. Why don't you remind us what happened in Birmingham?
The Birmingham campaign had been launched against police and the sheriff company of Bull Connor for many years before 1963. There had been clashes between the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Birmingham Police Force. And remember, it was under Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who had been leading the campaign to try to desegregate public facilities in Birmingham before, all the way up to 1963. And these confrontations had been going on for quite a while. But it was a matter of whether or not the civil rights forces would decide to target Birmingham, and because of its intransigence, and to actually use that as a way of defining what it actually is that they want out of this movement and the forces that are against it. Very clearly, in real life, this confrontation had to take place because this is what they wanted, and it did, and to some extent, many people paid a very high price for their participation in that Birmingham campaign. The four girls that were killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, and then all the people that were fired from their jobs as a result of having been arrested during the protests. And so they paid very dearly for this, but they made it clear what they wanted, and ultimately, a lot of people paid the heavy price, but ultimately they were able to get the president to send the civil rights bill to Congress in June of 1963, and then were able to mobilize 200,000 people to come to the March on Washington in August of 1963 to support the passage of the bill and also to support organized labor and working people's rights.
Now, you mentioned the young girls that died in the bombing, but there were quite a few others as well.
Yes, and the children who Crusades has been come to be defined as that period when the children and the teenagers in Birmingham saw what was happening to their parents and the involvement that their parents were in these campaigns, and that many of them had already gone to jail for this cause. You know, they said that, well, we're willing to make that sacrifice. We're willing to participate as well, because they understood what it was that their parents and their community was doing. They came to understand that they were doing the right thing and that this was important to them as children. To them, you know, this was important to me because it's important to them. They then decided that they were going to fill in where their holes in the lines, you know, in terms of representation in the protests by adults. So we have all of these graphic images now that were preserved of the children being hosed and attacked by dogs and placed in police cars and paddy wagons. So we have those images that are there, and they demonstrate the commitment of the children of Birmingham. But children throughout the civil rights movement participated in various campaigns. Children took a stand, mobilized, and participated in civil rights activism.
The other group that you have also written about that were very engaged were the African American women. And we know a lot about Rosa Parks, but there were others. Tell us about some of the key women within these movements, such as Ella Baker or Mary McLeod Bethune.
Mary McLeod Bethune was active in the 1930s and 1940s and, you know, died in 1955. And she was the head of the International Council of Negro Women and was the leading black figure and educator for her entire, almost a generation in terms of her importance and influence. But the way that we have been trying to document these women's participation and leadership of these various civil rights campaigns is by having the women tell their stories and find as many of these women as possible and have them tell their stories about their involvement, and then we record it and then make it available, and then it can become an oral history and an oral testimony that can be used when historians are telling the stories about those campaigns. They'll be able to interweave, you know, the individual women's stories. And so, most recently, you had the women in SNCC who decided to write about their stories. And now, this is a book that came out in 2011, Hands on the Freedom File, and where these women, and this is like 50 women, wrote about their experiences in SNCC. And so what we have been doing is making sure that the women who were active in Mississippi and still are in Mississippi get to tell their story, and the women in Alabama who were active in various civil rights campaigns to tell their stories. In other words, we've gone beyond the leaders, and we're now getting the stories of the participants and try to understand why average, ordinary people decided that they would be willing to put themselves on the line. And the reality is that the African-American women and their social and religious network was really the basis upon which the church aspects of the movement was held together. When you say that the civil rights movement developed in and around the black church, then who was the most important influence in the black church? Okay, the ministers, yes, the ministers and stuff, but also the women and the women's organizations. And ultimately, you find that it is the women that actually sustain these campaigns and sustain these leaders. You have the prize-winning book by Betty Collier Thomas, Jesus, Jobs, and Justice, African-American Women and Religion, deals specifically and in detail with the participation of women, religious women, and their church groups in these various civil rights campaigns and protests. And ultimately, they sustained them. They sustained them so that they could be successful.
If you were going to assess where we need to go from here, both for advancement of equality and also for advancement of race relations, what would you say?
There are all kinds of new opportunities that have come with Barack Obama's second term. And I think that one way that people can come together is to try to deal with the problems that exist in terms of the violence that exists in the society, and particularly that's affecting the children, and the problem of the incarceration and the problem of the high dropout rates. And so people can recognize that those are the problems that exist, and there's a need to do something about them. And they should be willing to accept something new to try to address this problem. For example, in the Journal of African American History, I discussed the creation of a reparation superfund and call on the NAACP to convene a meeting to establish an organization that would oversee this reparation superfund. And then just as people who were damaged by the BP spill went to the superfund and made claims, then people who are interested in dealing with the problem of violence and dropping out and all of these things and have programs that work would be able to appeal to this reparations superfund as well. And so that we would move beyond, we would say, okay, there are ways and programs out there to fight this. And many of them don't have enough money not only to expand, but not enough money to exist. And the banks and the financial institutions have already said that they have damaged people, and particularly African Americans, up to $25 billion worth, then they need to be depositing some of that money into a reparation superfund so we can do something about the violence and the killing that's going on in Chicago and Philadelphia and all of these cities. And I hope that the NAACP understands that we need to do something to try to deal with these problems.
VP Franklin, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
VP Franklin is Distinguished Professor of History at the University of California at Riverside. He is the editor of the Journal of African American History that was founded by Carter Woodson and is the author of several books, including The Education of Black Philadelphia, The Social and Educational History of a Minority Community, Black Self-Determination, A Cultural History of African American Resistance, and Living Our Stories, Telling Our Truths, Autobiography in the Making of African American Intellectual Tradition. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest suggests that the government may be overreacting and that the chance of being killed by an act of terrorism is far less than other dangers, such as gun violence. John Mueller is a research scientist and professor of political science at Ohio State University and author of War, Presidents, and Public Opinion. Mark Stewart is a professor of civil engineering and director of the Center for Infrastructure, Performance, and Reliability at the University of Newcastle in Australia. Together, they have co-authored Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, John Mueller, Mark Stewart. You've kind of opened your argument in your book saying that we've really not been asking the right questions. Maybe the right one isn't, are we safer? What do you think it should be, John Mueller?
Yes, it should not be, are we safer, but how safe are we? And that's where you'd really begin. The question is, do you want to spend more money to become even safer than you are now? And virtually no one ever brings up that question. You can calculate pretty easily, and a reasonable estimate is your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million per year if you're an American. And that includes 9/11 in the calculations. So the question, if you start from there, is that safe enough? Now, maybe you'd argue that, no, I won't be safe until it's 1 in 4 million or something, but that's the kind of discussion that should be there, not simply have we improved safety marginally from where it was 10 months ago or 10 years ago.
Mark Stewart.
The next question is, if you're going to spend a lot of money on homeland security measures, how much does it actually reduce that risk? So then you have to think about, well, if you can reduce the risk by a certain amount, that gives you a benefit. And does that actually exceed the cost of that measure? And in most cases, we've found that because the existing risk is so low, additional risk reduction actually causes a very small additional benefit. The costs are way, way higher than those potential benefits.
You compared the likelihood of being harmed or killed in a terrorist act versus other potential ways of dying, such as traffic accidents, industrial accidents, natural disasters. Let's break some of those down. John Mueller?
Yes. If your chance of being killed is 1 in 3.5 million, and you could argue that it's actually even lower than that, but if you start with that, you can certainly compare it to, for example, your chance of being killed in an automobile accident in the United States, which is about 1 in 8,000. or one chance in 22,000 of being a victim of homicide, or one chance in a million of dying by drowning in a bathtub, or one chance in about 7 million of being killed by lightning. Now, that's not the end of the discussion, obviously, and a lot of people point out correctly that terrorism has additional ramifications because it terrifies people and causes disruptions in the economy and anxiety more than some of those other hazards. So that should definitely be considered, but that's a good place to start. What is your chance of being killed, and do you really want to spend money on making it less likely that an American will be killed by terrorism when the chances now are 1 in 3.5 million, or, say, improving cancer research, or putting in smoke alarms, or reducing the dangers of driving on the highways?
Or gun violence.
Yes, definitely.
Mark Stewart?
So the risk assessment methods that we're actually using are nothing new. I mean, they've been applied to a whole range of existing hazards, going from nuclear power to hurricane protection to flood protection to pharmaceuticals to EPA regulations. So all we're really asking is that that same degree of scientific rigor gets applied to the hazards of terrorism.
Some of those hazards that Mark mentioned are very politically dicey. For example, in particular, nuclear radiation. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to very much consider that. It's not simply what the damage might be, but the emotional impact, etc. So regulators have for decades been dealing with these kinds of situations, both hazards that don't carry a huge emotional impact as well as ones that do.
Now, is the risk so low with regards to a terrorist attack because so much money is spent?
No, I don't think so. It certainly contributes. And obviously, you can start by saying, well, this is where it is now with the amount of spending we've been doing. And the question is, do you want to spend even more to make it even lower? Or if we relax some of the strictures that have been put in, it may increase the likelihood you'd be killed by a terrorist a little bit. But with that money, we could spend it on other hazards, which have far more lethal. It's not terribly clear. You know, 9/11 is standing out as this extreme aberration. It has not been a harbinger. And the various people have been caught and detained and have been incapable of creating remotely that kind of violence. So consequently, it's not obvious that the measures that have been put in place have stopped a huge number of 9/11s or things that are even worse.
Particularly, many of these measures took 2 or 3 years to actually implement after 9/11, and there were no attacks immediately following 9/11. So you could almost argue that maybe the threat isn't as high as we think it was.
So let's talk about how much money we actually do spend. You've calculated some of that. Where do we spend it, and how much do we spend it to battle terrorism?
And if you start to include some of the opportunity costs, such as the fact that if you make flying difficult for passengers, it becomes actually not a particularly pleasant experience by having long queues at the screening channels and all sorts of other issues. Then if you actually divert people to driving to the destination rather than flying, then that actually costs lives, because flying is much, much more safer than most other forms of transportation. So any security measure that actually deters people from using a safer mode of transport actually is costing lives rather than saving lives. So when you tally all of that in, the total cost exceeds more than $1 trillion since 9/11. And then if you include the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's another $1 trillion. So we're talking about serious amounts of money.
Let me add also, that is the increase since 9/11, not the total expenditures.
And then, of course, we've seen cutbacks in other programs and a lot of budget fights lately. How does this fit in with the politics that's going on right now in Congress?
Since budgets are not infinite, you have to make choices. The politicians and bureaucrats have to do that all the time. And so consequently, it seems to be their profound responsibility when you're dealing here with public safety, which is the foundational reason for government to begin with, that money should be spent in a way which improves public safety for the maximum amount, given how much money you have to spend. So to do it emotionally or to do it in a way that is extremely and absurdly risk-averse means that basically you're spending money that doesn't save very many lives when you could spend that same money that would improve public safety considerably more. But as far as we can see, that kind of calculation, which is extremely basic and straightforward and simple, is not really put into place when you get into this area.
Just to follow on John's question, the other thing that's a concern is the expenditure is still increasing. It shows no sign of trying to level off. So the issue is, you know, where do you draw the line? And when we compare the expenditures to the UK, Australia, and Canada, US expenditures probably 2 to 4 times higher on a per capita basis or per GDP basis or any other standard metric. So the US expenditures really stands out compared to what other countries are doing.
And what is it that you see that it's primarily being spent on? I saw some of the things in your books about every time a container comes through customs, there's just all this extra process. But what would you say the top anti-terrorist expenses are?
Probably the biggest single lump of money goes towards the Transportation Security Administration, and that's really aimed at the aviation security. And if I had to pick something from aviation security, it would be the Federal Air Marshal Service. This is the service that has about 3,000 to 4,000 air marshals. And the intent of these is to sit on aircraft and to try to stop potential terrorists accessing the cockpit door to stop a repeat of the 9/11 attacks. And 3,000 to 4,000 air marshals sounds like a lot of air marshals, but there's something like 60,000 flights a day in the United States. So they only cover probably no more than 5 to 10% of flights, and that's both domestic and international. They cost more than $1.2 billion a year. So it's a very expensive service. Since they hardened the cockpit doors, you know, very soon after 9/11, that really closed the vulnerability. And in the last 11 or 12 years, the air marshals actually have done nothing. There hasn't been a single terrorist incident that they can claim to have averted. Other countries don't have air marshal services. Australia has actually cut back on its number, and there's a large number of European countries who actually never even had them. So that's probably one of the specific items of expenditure which we think is heavily excessive.
Another way of looking at this is that after 9/11, in a state of panic, a huge amount of money was thrown at this problem. Now, that's perfectly understandable. We all remember the atmosphere after 9/11. The most basic kind of common sense is that when you spend a lot of money in haste, whether it's government or business or personal, you're likely to misspend a fair amount of that money. After a few years, one would think, you'd want to go back and revisit those expenditures. Some of them, maybe just out of pure luck, proved to be really quite cost-effective and really valuable in reducing the risk at a reasonable cost. Others surely have been wasteful because they've been so hastily put together and so under-considered. So what we've been trying to do is to do exactly that, and I must say quite surprised at in many respects, is that no one has done this really systematically, including the Department of Homeland Security. After 2 or 3 years, you'd think, well, we should do a stock-taking. Or maybe after the administration changes and you say, okay, we've been through this thing for years now, it's not time to see if this is really sensibly put together. But as far as we can see, that hasn't been done.
With the revelations of the NSA and Edward Snowden, I'm assuming these would be even extra costs that you didn't get into your calculations.
They're somewhat in there. About 45% of the increased expenditures have been on protection, like TSA and putting border guard and putting up bollards around airports and so forth. And another 45% has been on increased policing and intelligence. Our book mostly deals with the former, the protection measures. You know, it doesn't make sense to try to fortify a building against a terrorist attack. And a lesser amount in the book, the Terror Security and Money book, deals with policing. But we're now beginning to look at that as well to see if the FBI, for example, and their $3 billion they spend on counterterrorism, whether that's cost-effective or not.
Now, I was also struck by how much fear people still felt and concern about terrorist attacks years after 9/11. And some of that, you said, is a result of, it's a kind of a new coining of a term, the terrorism industry. How would you characterize this?
That's my phrase there. What happens is you have people who are very much afraid of something, and then you have a lot of people who see, hey, there's gold in those hills. And so you have basically politicians, bureaucrats, and people selling things to the government realize that there's this need, this fear out there that they can basically service and do well at, and the media, by the way. So there's a tendency to exacerbate the threat. If you're going to sell x-ray machines to the government and you find the government really is desperately suddenly in need of x-ray machines, you pussyfoot it quickly over to Washington. And when you get there, you don't say you don't really need these x-ray machines. Instead, you're likely to sort of exacerbate the threat. In terms of the public opinion, however, and that's the driving factor on this in many respects, I think, it is impressive, as you mentioned initially, that the fears of terrorism do not seem to have subsided much since the end of 2001. For example, when asked on polls at the end of 2001 whether they were worried that they or a family member might be a victim of terrorism, about 40% said yes. that number still is pretty much at that same level, even after the death of bin Laden and even 12 years later. So I don't think necessarily the terrorism industry has created this perception, but they certainly have an incentive to exacerbate it and to work with it.
Mark Stewart?
There's also no reason, to link public opinion to what the actual expenditures are. In the Australian experience, we had our Prime Minister at the time was John Howard, and he was a very close ally to George Bush and the US.
In Australia?
In Australia. And his rhetoric was extremely strong. I think George Bush labelled him the man of steel and all those sort of very strong statements. And the Australian public liked that. And he was also very successful politically. But the spending did not match the rhetoric. And that's the thing. You can still be strong on terrorism, have strong statements, have a lot of public support, obviously spend some money, to close some of the important vulnerabilities. But you can still be successful politically. So I think what the US stands out amongst other countries is how the spending has almost exceeded the rhetoric.
Another way of looking at that is that although the public is definitely saying, I want to be safe or safer or whatever, it doesn't follow that they're saying, we want to take off our shoes before you get into airplanes. We want to have air marshals on a large number of flights and so forth. So even though there is this concern out there, it does not mean that politicians have to spend $1 trillion. And as Mark suggests, that other countries have also felt pressure. They have spent more money, definitely, but not nearly as much proportionally as the United States, and those politicians are still in office. So the argument that bureaucrats and politicians frequently make is we have to do this because, otherwise we'd be thrown out of office. It simply doesn't bear up under that experience.
When you look at the budget fights that are going on now, it would seem that they would stop and think logically about how much we really need to spend to have that little bit more safety. But it really speaks also to the power of fear, how debilitating fear can be, and the behavioral consequences. John Mueller?
Yes, they can. If you've got 40% of the people worrying, if your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million, the idea that you worry about it at all is pretty absurd. But no one is ever saying this. One politician once said something like this. It was Mayor Bloomberg in 2007. And that's where the discussion should begin. And I suppose from the bureaucratic standpoint, the problem is if you say, well, your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million per year, you're afraid that the answer will then be, well, then how come we're giving you so much money? The important thing is to spend the money in a manner that maximizes public safety, not simply to preserve your job or your department.
Our experience has been is that the public actually gets it. They can see the risk of terrorism compared to other hazards. They can see that the spending seems out of whack of what the actual risks actually are. So once you actually go through and explain the process and put data and numbers to this and compare risks to other hazards, it doesn't come across as controversial at all.
Thank you so much for being with us, John Mueller. Mark Stewart, it's great to have you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Up next, the strange political marriage of Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon and how their terms shaped U.S. politics and policy for decades to come. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. The closeness that may develop between presidents and their vice presidents rarely continues after their term ends. But Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon seem inextricably bound to one another, partly as a result of Nixon's political tactics and also from the development of family ties. It wasn't a particularly good relationship, as our next guest has documented, but the relationship endured and shaped the United States politics and policy for decades to come. Jeffrey Frank is with us now. He is a journalist and author of several books, including this one, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Welcome, Jeffrey Frank.
Hi, thanks to be here.
It's great to have you here. I wanted to start with the general characters of these two former presidents, Dick and Ike, as you call them. It seems like they both had an enormous capacity for deception.
These were two men that could not have been less alike when they first met. And it was sort of like a dance around each other. Eisenhower, the whole country called him Ike, even though he was one of only four or five-star generals. And he was sort of a beloved figure, a truly beloved figure. He's the one who had led the Allied Expeditionary Force on the Normandy invasion. He was basically the leader who defeated the Nazis in Europe. Nixon, he was 62 years old, looked a little older, grandfatherly. He smoked three packs a day. That probably got to him, a lot of coffee and a war. Nixon was a 39-year-old Orange County senator at that point. And Eisenhower had met him briefly a couple of times, but they did not know each other. And although it's always said that Eisenhower picked Nixon, in fact, he was picked for Eisenhower by a number of advisors. Later on, Eisenhower was asked, you know, how did you actually select him? And Eisenhower said, well, it was a list of six people, and he was on the list.
Nixon had failed in a number of careers. How did he rise to the presidency, and how would you contrast that with Eisenhower?
Eisenhower basically won the presidency by acclamation. Both parties wanted Eisenhower to run. The Americans for Democratic Action wanted Eisenhower to run. Franklin Roosevelt's son, Jimmy, wanted Eisenhower to run as a Democrat. Everyone wanted Eisenhower. At one point, they were talking about having him run as a Republican and a Democrat. They would separate these two parties by having different vice presidents. That was just a notional idea. Nixon, on the other hand, struggled and struggled and struggled. And he had a rise and a fall and a rise again. And just to quickly go through his history, he ran for Congress in 1946, running against a five-term Democratic incumbent. He won partially because he was young and a veteran and a really good campaigner, partially because he was using the red issue, the communist issue, which was just beginning to show up. It wasn't as big as it was going to be after Senator McCarthy made his famous speech. And he won partly because he had the support of the Los Angeles Times, which at that point was not only the dominant paper, but the political director was also the man who wrote the editorials. He was the man who wrote a column, and he loved Dick Nixon, and he really wanted him to be in Congress. So he won that race. He won it pretty substantially. He won again. Then he ran probably the campaign that people never forgive him for, or at least Democrats never forgive him for, in 1950 against a woman named Helen Douglas, who was also a congresswoman. She'd had three terms. That was his nastiest campaign. That's when the red issue really came in with full intensity. He was coached by a man named Murray Chotiner, who was sort of the Karl Rove of his day. Murray Chotiner, his sort of dictum was, destroy your opponent. That's how you win a race. And Nixon really went after her. And he won by a substantial margin. He won by 600,000 votes. The only one who had a bigger margin in 1950 was Earl Warren, who became governor of California. And in the summer of 1950, Nixon was invited to the Bohemian Grove, this exclusive men's club north of San Francisco. And the host-in-chief was Herbert Hoover, the former president, who loved the Bohemian Grove. And he also invited Dwight D. Eisenhower, who at that point was president of Columbia University. And Eisenhower was invited to give a lakeside talk, the sort of important talk of the event. And people were already talking about Eisenhower for president again, this time as a Republican. Of course, no one at the Grove wanted him. They were really quite conservative, this bunch, and they wanted Bob Taft, a senator from Ohio, who sort of satisfied them. But anyway, Eisenhower was there, Nixon was there. They talked briefly, and that was their first meeting. And they met once more in Paris when I was helping to set up NATO. And then they showed up at the convention. Eisenhower was the favorite of the Eastern Republicans, and Nixon was kind of being pushed by a number of Eastern Republicans, including the former New York governor, the governor Tom Dewey, and, of course, his friend Murray Chotiner, which really annoyed Earl Warren, who hoped himself to be a favorite son candidate from California. This is the delegation that Senator Nixon was in.
The Bohemian Grove, you mentioned that you had a whole chapter on it.
Yeah.
And you said it's different from other exclusive clubs as well. How was it different?
Well, in one way, it was all men. They had these sort of rituals, the cremation of care ceremony. It was very secretive, sort of. Less so now. You can actually go on YouTube and go to Bohemian Grove, and you'll see the torchlight parade and all that sort of thing. The clientele were wealthy businessmen, show business personalities. In those days, people like Edgar Bergen. Actually, the summer that Nixon was invited by Herbert Hoover, he wanted Conrad Hilton, the hotel guy, who thought they could maybe give them some tips on catering the summer. There were no women, and there still are no women allowed. I suppose partly because the men prance around naked at one point. But there are some women who help out with serving and so on. Herbert Hoover called it the greatest men's party on earth. And so it was a big deal. Nixon, later on in the tapes, was not very nice about it. But at the time, he was really happy to be there.
Now we have President Eisenhower, well, before he's president, when he's running, and he essentially lets other people choose Richard Nixon, Dick Nixon, to be his running mate. He didn't even know, as you said in the book, that he could choose the vice presidential candidate.
No.
And he never really liked Nixon all that much.
He didn't, I won't say he disliked him, but he was never really fond of him. They were so different. As a general rule, he didn't like professional politicians. Tom Dewey, the man who sort of worked hardest, or one of those who worked hardest to get him nominated, I still couldn't stand him. There are a couple of exceptions. Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., who was a senator, but he qualified as sort of being from a good old Eastern family. He was sort of in Eisenhower's sort of circle in a way, but no. Nick was sort of a scrappy hustler to Eisenhower and staff. He was still Lieutenant Commander Nixon, and Eisenhower was still General Eisenhower. You have to remember, by the way, that Eisenhower, when he left the presidency, did not want to be addressed as Mr. President. He wanted to be General Eisenhower.
You implied that they both had this ability to be kind of cruel, or that maybe even Nixon picked this up, cruel while appearing to be warm and kind.
Yeah, I mean, Nixon did some terrible things later on. But in their relationship, while Eisenhower was president and Nixon was under him, it was Eisenhower, and I'm not saying that even Eisenhower was intentionally cruel. It was sort of a casual cruelty, not being really aware of how he was deflating Nixon, hurting his feelings. I mean, he was constantly slighting him. First place, there was, I don't know if you want me to go into the fund scandal, but right after they were both on the ticket, Nixon went to visit Eisenhower in Fraser, Colorado. I'm not sure it was bonding or whatever. And Eisenhower tried to teach him how to fly fish. Eisenhower loved fly fishing. He loved bridge and he loved golf. None of which, Nixon could do none of it. Nixon later on forced himself to learn golf. I actually interviewed a man who caddied for him the summer he was teaching himself golf. And so he was a disaster. You could actually look at, there's a URL in the index of the book where you can sort of see a newsreel of Nixon trying to cast and catching the hook on his chest. So that's sort of a disaster. So they go off. Nixon's on in the West Coast and Eisenhower is sort of in the Middle West. When the New York Post breaks a story called Nixon's Secret Fund. It wasn't really a secret. Nixon had actually told another reporter about it. It wasn't, by today's standards, it wasn't even much of a scandal. $16,000, all of which was accounted for in pretty good bookkeeping, was being used to supplement his office expenses. But it just didn't sound good, and it particularly didn't sound good at a moment when the Eisenhower campaign was, let's clean house with Ike and Dick. And by cleaning house, they were talking about Harry Truman and the Truman scandals. Harry Truman himself wasn't implicated in it, but the people around Truman were sort of, there were all kinds of things going on. Government contractors were, there's a 5% bonus that was being paid. Mink coats were being given out. Deep freezes were being given to people. Actually, Mrs. Truman got a deep freeze. And I think they claimed that, oh, well, it broke down, so it really doesn't count. So it was called the mess in Washington. So it really was bad to have even a taint of scandal. So Eisenhower at one point told reporters this, we have to be as clean as a hound's tooth. That was a famous thing. And he pretty quickly wanted Nixon to leave the ticket. His good friend, General Lucius Clay, thought Nixon should go. The man Eisenhower was probably closest to all his life was his brother Milton, who definitely thought Nixon should go. But Eisenhower being Eisenhower, and Eisenhower was that he couldn't act directly. Eisenhower couldn't say, Dick, I want you off the ticket. He just let Nixon hang there, and they finally gave him the chance to go on national TV to explain himself. Eisenhower said, I want you to explain every nickel, every dime that's ever come in. And there was a sort of full-scale audit of all of Nixon's finances by Price Waterhouse. I think 50 people worked day and night. And so Nixon had to give this speech. And before he went on, he asked Eisenhower, so after I'm done, will you make a decision? And Eisenhower said, well, let's just give it a little more time. And Nixon said a very rude thing, which I can't repeat on the air, but in his memoirs, in one memoir it came out, General, there comes a time when you have to fish or cut bait. But that still wasn't. Just before Nixon went on the air and to give a speech that was going to explain everything, he got a call from Tom Dewey saying, Dick, I hate to tell you this, but we really think when you finish your speech tonight, you should resign from the ticket.
And
you
can, from the Senate,
and
right?
You can really make yourself look good by giving up your Senate seat, too, and then you'll win in a huge special election, and you'll come back a hero. And Nixon just was speechless. He was already nervous, rattled, scared to death. His whole career was going down the drain. And he said, you'll just have to wait. And he did. He gave his speech talking about his finances, the mortgage, how much money he owed, what his parents were, how he'd grown up and worked in a grocery store. He did not mention that two of his brothers had died when they were young. And he finished the speech and mentioned, and it became called the Checker speech because he mentioned that the family had been given a little black and white Cocker Spaniel and his daughter Tricia named it Checkers. And he said, and we're going to keep it. People today look at it as this maudlin, oozy speech, even though actually Mamie Eisenhower apparently shed a tear. But if you look back at that time, in 1952, looking at a black and white television, this young guy under siege, the Milton Berle show goes off the air, and here's this guy speaking, begging for your understanding. And he defied Eisenhower. He said, write to the Republican National Committee and tell them what you think. And by gosh, thousands and thousands of people did just that, and Eisenhower was kind of trapped. Nixon beat him. The lieutenant defeated the general, and Eisenhower knew it.
This was one of the real attempts for Eisenhower to move Nixon out.
Yeah, that was the first one, the big one. Nixon's daughter, Julie, wrote about it. She said every September 23rd, which was the day that he gave the speech, he would say, you know what today is? It's the anniversary of that speech. And he said one time it was a scar that never healed. His wife, Pat, never got over it. She hated politics from that day on. It was a devastating moment. And even though Nixon went on and Eisenhower went on, that thing was always in the background, I think, between them, even though they never spoke of it again.
So he really outmaneuvered Eisenhower in this.
Yeah.
Was there another incident like that?
Well, 4 years later, Eisenhower was going to run for re-election, and this came after a very difficult and delicate moment. Eisenhower had a major heart attack. No one at the time knew quite how serious this thing was. In the first place, he was being treated by a doctor who really didn't know what to do, and for hours, this doctor sat with him, gave him morphine shots, and it was just by the grace of God that Eisenhower didn't die. In the morning, they called an ambulance. He was taken to the hospital, and even though he was critical, but he recovered, and during that time, government sort of went on without him. Really, no one was in charge. It was basically a government by committee. But Nixon really comported himself well. Everyone really got a high regard for him. He was dignified. He didn't try to assert himself. The press praised him. John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, really thought he'd done well. And that was a period when Foster Dulles, no one could have been less like Nixon than Foster Dulles. But Foster Dulles did like Nixon. He began to sort of mentor him in some way. Eisenhower, though, it did something to Eisenhower, the sort of seeing this young guy. And also, Eisenhower really, really wanted to get someone else. As he would say, we need to bring other people up. So he wanted Nixon replaced. They had several conversations in the spring of 56 after Eisenhower recovered and decided he was going to run again. At one time, he offered him a cabinet post. Nick, I think you want to be Secretary of Defense. It'd be good for you to learn to run something. I think he said, you can have any job you want except state, which was going to go to Herbert Hoover Jr., which would never have happened, or justice. And he thought Nixon didn't have the experience for that. But Nixon knew that whether or not Eisenhower was trying to help him or not, it would be perceived as if he'd been dumped. And so this went on. And Eisenhower said, I'm going to have a meeting. We're going to discuss the next election. And Dick, I would of course, invite you, but it could be difficult if you weren't there. So we're going to have this. And it went on. These conversations continued. And someone said it was a moment of absolute agony. And it wasn't like the Checker speech, because it went on and on and on. These conversations started basically in January, and they didn't end until April, when Nixon again kind of pushed himself back on the ticket. He managed to get himself a New Hampshire senator named Stiles Bridges, sort of organized a write-in vote in a primary in which Nixon wasn't running, that showed Nixon had this powerful base out there. And finally, Eisenhower basically saw there was really no way to do it without basically having a public statement, I want him off the ticket. So Nixon survived. Though, even when Nixon thought he'd survived, a man named Harold Stassen, unquestionably with Eisenhower's assent, was trying to promote the governor of Massachusetts, Christian Herter, and then that failed too. And Nixon was not only renominated, but poor Harold Stassen was sort of pushed into doing the renomination.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Jeffrey Frank, and the book is called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Joe McCarthy, very big role at the time. How did McCarthyism play into their relationship?
You know, everyone thinks that Nixon and McCarthy at a certain period were these twin spirits. And in some way, they were both very aggressive sort of red hunters in the 40s. Nixon was a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Nixon's reputation came because he went after Alger Hiss, a man named Alger Hiss. For better words, Alger Hiss was convicted of perjury for lying about having passed documents to the Russians. This is a case that people still want to argue about, but that's not the subject of this book. But that made his reputation. Eisenhower said to him, Dick, I think you got him, and you got him fairly. That's the way Nixon wanted to be thought of in the Hiss case. Nixon thought McCarthy was out of his mind, basically. He didn't use that language. He thought he was reckless. He threw charges out. He wasn't being a lawyer and became more and more irresponsible. And after he made his famous speech in 1950s about 205 communists, which then became 57 communists, and not one communist, by the way, ever was shown to be in whatever it was, the State Department, McCarthy took sort of going further and further and began to take on the army and all kinds of whether a man named Peres was promoted. It gets very complicated. But in any case, this was Eisenhower's beloved army. And after Adlai Stevenson made a speech saying you cannot have a party that's half Eisenhowerism and half McCarthyism, Eisenhower said, enough's enough, Dick, I want you to go on television and take both of them on. And Nixon was happy taking on Adlai Stevenson. He'd done that before. He'd done that in 52 when they ran against him. But taking on McCarthy was a very delicate thing for him because he had to take on someone who was an anti-communist, and Nixon was an anti-communist, and he had to take on someone who represented part of the party's base, and Nixon didn't want to lose that, and yet he understood he had to do it. So he threaded this very delicate needle, and it came at a time after a famous broadcast by Edward R. Murrow had talked about McCarthy basically indicting people without evidence, and so it was somewhat easier, but he hated to make the speech. He hated to have to being ordered to go on the air and attack Senator McCarthy. But he did it. And he did it by not mentioning McCarthy's name, but he said, you know, there are cases when people are accused of a crime and they have a right to face their accusers, they have a right to have a full hearing, and there are people today who are just recklessly throwing these things around. Everyone knew who he was talking about. So he did it, and he pleased Eisenhower. He really annoyed McCarthy, but McCarthy, a year later, was censured by the Senate, and Nixon went on to better things.
Was that the time when President Nixon was preparing to do the speech and Eisenhower said, you must work in a couple of smiles, and he just was
That's right.
terrified of that idea?
That's right. He had to work in a smile. And actually, this is sort of a funny story. Nixon was completely keyed up for the speech. He went up to a suite in the Statler Hotel in downtown Washington with a guy named Jim Bassett, he had been a newspaper man who was helping Nixon. Nixon said, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. And Bassett said, I think he seems to have forgotten the fun speech a couple of years ago. And at one point, a famous cabaret singer of the time named Hildegard was singing downstairs. Nixon said, why don't we get Hildegard up and just to talk and so on to our room? And she apparently took it as a huge joke and just said no. I don't think Nixon had anything untoward in mind. He just sort of thought it would be fun to have Hildegard come up.
And this was also, of course, when the concerns over Vietnam were starting to bubble up. Eisenhower initially said that he didn't want to get the United States into another war. What was his strategy? What was Nixon's?
This was when the French were being defeated in a small little battleground called Dien Bien Phu. And Nixon had been there. Nixon had taken a big Asian trip a year before. He knew very well that if the French couldn't hold on, the people who were going to be governing this country was going to be, the Ho Chi Minh, the Viet Minh, the communist regime. They were the only ones capable of governing it. Nixon knew this, but he thought America should intervene. And that was the last thing Eisenhower wanted to do, was to get into any kind of war in Southeast Asia. He managed to get us out of the Korean War within 6 months after becoming president. And he could do it because he was Eisenhower. He was the five-star general. He was the supreme commander of the Allied forces. He had promised to visit Korea. He did go, and he basically saw, why are we sending troops in to try and take a hill that we're simply going to lose? This is an unsustainable war. Within 6 months of being president, we got out. There was an armistice, and in a way, that's the situation today. There's basically a ceasefire that's endured for 60 years or so. But Nixon thought we should help the French, but with air power. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, at one point Admiral Radford, thought we should send three nuclear bombs go in. We cannot even imagine what would have happened to the world if they had done that. This insane idea, but that was not going to go anywhere. And Eisenhower basically did all he could to stop any kind of involvement. He said, we'll talk to Congress, knowing that Congress would have hated the idea. Well, we'll consult with our allies, knowing very well that Winston Churchill had no intention of helping the French preserve their empire since the British had already lost their empire. And so Eisenhower very cleverly kept us away from any kind of war there. To be honest, though, Eisenhower did send money to the French. He helped pay for the French war there, and he sent them weapons. But our engagement in Vietnam was at that point limited to very, very little support, and he had helped prop up the Diem regime, which was then, as you know, overthrown when the Kennedys took office. And when he was overthrown, and by the way, this time Henry Cabot Lodge was the ambassador then, and then Lyndon Johnson became president, and the war was then escalated from Kennedy's 16,000 advisors to Lyndon Johnson's 550,000 soldiers, and the war that we've never forgotten.
And we have to talk about the civil rights era because there was so much that occurred during this time, Brown versus Board of Education. There were a couple of civil rights bills over that period of time. Nixon supported them. Yeah. Eisenhower didn't. What happened?
Well, Eisenhower supported the bills because his party supported the bills. Eisenhower hated Brown versus Board of Education. He hated the idea. He thought it was completely disruptive of the society. It's not something he could say. And he was good about following the law. To jump ahead when there was a big crisis in Little Rock, Arkansas, Eisenhower did the right thing. And he did it in the way a general of the army would do it. He sent an overpowering force. No one was hurt, no one was killed, and the Little Rock Nine went to school. Martin Luther King Jr. met Nixon for the first time in Ghana at the independence ceremonies for the Gold Coast, which became Ghana. And he told people, he said, Nixon, he was raised a Quaker and he seems to be without prejudice. And I think deep down, Nixon had prejudices, everyone does, but outwardly, Nixon said and did the right thing, and he wanted to do the right thing about civil rights. In 1954, during one of his worst campaigns, he made a stop at Wilmington, Delaware, and someone said, what about, they brought up the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which had come out in May of 54, and Nixon made a very eloquent speech. He said, you know, my daughters go to school with Negroes, and over 600 million people in this world are not white, and if we're going to win their attention or respect, we have to show that we're a society that respects equality. And he meant it. He was the man who worked hard for the administration to support the 1957 Civil Rights Bill, which at the time was sort of a landmark. Lyndon Johnson is given credit for it, and Johnson certainly worked to pass the bill, but Johnson wanted a watered-down Voting Rights Act, and Johnson at that time was playing all kinds of games. He wanted to run for president, so he couldn't alienate the North, but he didn't want to alienate the Southern Democrats like Richard Russell. And Nixon pushed very hard, and the voting rights provision of the 57 Civil Rights Act was stronger because of the administration, and Nixon was the man working for it. Martin Luther King, who met with Nixon several times, praised him for it. Jackie Robinson, who was, I'm not sure he was a friend of Nixon, but they were very, very friendly, and he wrote Nixon congratulatory notes for all the great work you did. And it's important to remember that even the Nixon who later on supported the so-called Southern Strategy, he did work to desegregate Southern schools as president. And unlike George H.W. Bush, unlike Ronald Reagan, and unlike Goldwater, he supported the 1964 Civil Rights Act and did so publicly. He broke with Martin Luther King in 1960, or King broke with him because Nixon did something very cowardly. When King was arrested on a completely trumped-up charge, he had been arrested for driving without a license or something, he was sent in chains off to Reidsville Prison in Georgia. And when Mrs. King called, please help, she was terrified her husband was going to be killed. And she had very good reasons to think he might be. The police in Georgia at that time were horrible, what they were doing to black people in Georgia. And the Kennedy campaign, Bobby and or Robert and John Kennedy, stepped up and did something, and Martin Luther King was released. And I think it's clear that Nixon lost a lot of support from the black voters then. If he had won them, he very well might have carried a couple of more states and very well might have been president.
And you mentioned Kennedy, and that's another important point. He and John F. Kennedy were actually relatively close when they were in the Senate, but then things deteriorated.
Competition will do that to you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were very friendly. I mentioned that really nasty campaign against Helen Gahagan Douglas. And shortly afterward, Kennedy spoke to some students at Harvard and said, I'm really glad that Nixon beat her. I would hate to work with someone like her in the Senate. Nixon was invited to the Kennedy wedding. When Kennedy was very ill with a back problem and Nixon was vice president and they had to reorganize the Senate, he preserved Kennedy's spot in the hierarchy. And Mrs. Kennedy wrote to him thanking him, saying she thinks the world of you. They were very friendly. And Nixon was asked to support Kennedy's membership in the Burning Tree Country Club and did so. But when Nixon was nominated for vice president, one of the first congratulatory notes came from Jack Kennedy. But, as I say, competition brings out the worst in everyone. When they ran against each other for president, there was a breach between them that would never heal. Kennedy began to speak with them with complete contempt. Nixon just said he was never going to lose an election that way again. He felt the Kennedys were ruthless, and he also felt the elections had been stolen from him.
And when the assassination occurred,
I think that was almost the worst thing that ever happened to Nixon. He was a happy guy then. He'd lost the governorship of California, sort of a humiliation. So that was it for California. He moved to New York. He joined a law firm. He was doing very well. He got an apartment at 810 Fifth Avenue, which is a very nice building. He was in the same building that Governor Nelson Rockefeller had an apartment. He was earning a lot of money. His two daughters, Tricia and Julie, were going to the Chapin School. Pat loved being in New York. They would go to musicals. They would walk down. Checkers was 12 years older. They would go strolling down Fifth Avenue. And Nixon swore to a columnist. He said, I'm never going to run again. I'm not going to run in 68, in 72, in 64. Anyone who thinks I'm ever going to run for office again is out of his mind. And I think he meant it. And then Kennedy was killed, and everything changed. Nixon could begin to taste it again. He could sort of see it again. I think, there's no question, he wanted to. He would have loved the nomination in 64. He already sensed that Lyndon Johnson was vulnerable. And when that wasn't going to happen, the competition came down to Barry Goldwater and Nelson Rockefeller. He already began to look ahead to 68. As a politician, he was like a brilliant chess player. He could see several moves ahead.
During this time, Eisenhower, now General Eisenhower again, had started being ill. He started having heart attack after heart attack.
Right.
How did he treat Nixon when he decided to run again?
He'd had several heart attacks, and as you say, and they got worse and worse. There was something else that was happening at this time, too. In 1967, Eisenhower's grandson, David, announced to the family that he was engaged to Julie Nixon, Nixon's younger daughter. which was an amazing thing. They were kids. They were 19 years old when they announced this, and they were going to get married. And in fact, a year later, when they were both 20 years old, they did get married. And so that influenced Eisenhower's decision. Eisenhower always didn't want to get involved in these nomination fights. He said, I'll support the party's nominee and that sort of thing. And it was a way to avoid supporting Nixon early. But this time there was no way out, and they were sort of a family now. He still waited till pretty much the last moment, but Eisenhower was pretty close to being on his deathbed when he endorsed Nixon. He endorsed him in the early summer of 1968, and in July of that year, Nixon got the nomination for president.
One of the funniest aspects of your book was when there was this famous quote from Eisenhower when a journalist asked about what major idea did Nixon offer you during your presidency that you then adopted, Eisenhower said.
Yeah, if you give me a week, I'll think of one. And that was 1960. It was devastating. Eisenhower told people, oh, I wish I'd never said that damn quote and so on. But he said it. It took a while for him to take it back. Nixon was completely devastated by it. He really didn't know what to do. So what he did do, he went on a talk show. He went on the Jack Parr Show, which was the show that Johnny Carson then took over, which is now being done by Jay Leno. And he had a chance to say, well, you know, Eisenhower, the president, is, of course, right. He does make the final decision, but he had also a chance to say that I was in on everything. I was a vice president. He included me in all of his councils and the cabinet and so on.
Before he passed away, he did get involved in Nixon's foreign policy to some degree. How much?
I mean, at the very end, after Nixon was president, yeah. It turns out to be the first 2 months of the Nixon presidency. And I would say the first 2 months of the Nixon presidency were a huge success. There was no war in Vietnam. I mean, there was the war. It was Lyndon Johnson's war still. Nixon had been warned by a very prescient columnist named David Halberstam, you have about 4 months to find a way to get out of this, or it's going to be Nixon's war. And of course, that's what it turned into. He was being very inventive. The administration, you know, went on to sort of create the Environmental Protection Agency, sort of equal hiring, federal employment. The sort of universal food stamps came along. He had appointed Daniel Patrick Moynihan to sort of advise on domestic policy, and they came up with an idea for a negative income tax. Some of these things didn't go anywhere, but it was a very inventive, imaginative administration, and Nixon apparently would sit in some of these meetings himself. And in foreign policy, Eisenhower advised him to stay out of the Middle East, because once you put your hand there, then you become the guarantor of any agreement and so on. And Eisenhower got very involved. He suggested that Nixon should appoint Herbert Brownell, who had been Eisenhower's attorney general, to be on the Supreme Court. There was even some talk about Eisenhower being a sort of super advisor, but that never would have happened. Eisenhower was very, very ill. But Ike would pick up the phone and just say, "Mr. President, and so on." It was the one time when I won't say they were close, and they certainly weren't friends, but there was a real sort of almost equality between them. And they actually, and that Thanksgiving, they'd had a real family dinner together, because they were family now. How odd to think of that.
Again, the book is called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. The author is with us, Jeffrey Frank. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.